Good afternoon, everyone. It's a little bit after 1:30, our scheduled recess ending time. And so we'll bring the hearing back to order in HP09-001, Transcant Keystone Pipeline LP. We were proceeding with staff's direct case, and Ms. Semler, please call your next witness.
I would ask Mr. James Arndt to please take the stand. Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Good afternoon. Could you please introduce yourself and give us a little explanation of your work and educational background?
Okay. My name is James Arndt. I work for Natural Resource Group as a senior consultant. My address is 1000 IDS Center, 80 South 8th Street in Minneapolis, Minnesota. My educational background, I have my BS in Soils and Natural Resource Management from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and my master's and my PhD in soil science from North Dakota State University. My educational background is I spent 15 years as the supervisor of the Soil and Water Environmental Laboratory and in other various capacities for North Dakota State University in that soils laboratory. We worked with the NRCS doing cooperative soil survey investigations in North Dakota, both East and West North Dakota. I performed soil water compatibility analyses and soil salinity analyses, and I actually specialized in wetlands investigations. I worked at North Dakota State University until 1995, and in 1995, I went to Minneapolis and became a consultant for Peterson Environmental Consulting, where my primary responsibilities were to do soils investigations, wetlands work. I did several portions of environmental impact statements, one for Devil's Lake, the Devil's Lake outlet in North Dakota. And I started doing a lot of pipeline work. In 1996, we did a soils investigation to take a look at soils limitations for the Alliance Pipeline, utilizing GIS and NRCS digital soils products. We expanded that into doing three or four other projects for Peterson Environmental Consulting. I left Peterson Environmental Consulting 4 years ago to go to Natural Resource Group, where I have been working primarily in soils issues and wetlands issues, again doing resource reports for soils and geology. I've also been involved in writing agricultural impact mitigation plans in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois, and also completed a couple of organic farm appendices to those plans.
And did you write and submit pre-filed testimony for this proceeding?
I did.
And do you see that there beside you as S4?
S4, I do.
And if you were asked those questions today, would you answer them the same? Do you have any corrections or deletions of any sort?
No corrections or deletions. I would answer the questions in the same manner.
What portions of the application did you review?
I reviewed the soils portion, which was section 5.3.4, the erosion and sedimentation section to determine whether a sufficient level of detail was provided to assess limitations and soil-related hazards along the pipeline right-of-way. I also reviewed the construction mitigation plan, the CMRP, to determine if those items would sufficiently be addressed, soil limitations and hazards be sufficiently addressed, such that the affected areas could be properly restored to the extent practicable.
Were any questions you had based on that review sufficiently answered by the applicant through the discovery process?
I did have originally several questions on the application, and to give TransCanada credit, I did ask several specific questions for more detail on soils-related limitations and soils-related hazards, and they were all appropriately addressed in their responses, primarily in response three for staff. And one of the things that I would like to actually expand upon that was present in the responses that TransCanada produced, I did provide a couple of resources, and these are actually in the record, so they don't have to be addressed again. But one of the things that I did ask is for additional soils information in order to establish more completely the distribution of soil characteristics and soil limitations along the right-of-way in South Dakota. This was done by assessing the in a GIS, assessing the spatial distribution of soils along the right-of-way, and then utilizing the digital attribute data to identify specific characteristics and limitations that would affect soil quality and also constructability and several other issues. This is common technology that is used and that I have used on several pipeline projects. And what we have in the first table is an example of the detailed soil analysis that TransCanada did provide. And what it basically shows is all of the information that would be provided in a soil survey, mile posted by entry and exit mile posts for the entire route through South Dakota. It identifies the map units, the soil map units by mile post, and it also shows several specific limitations. And these are mile posted again as they would be in the county soil survey. And the type of limitations that we have are shallow bedrock, all shallow restrictive layers, drought-prone soils, steeply sloping soils, saline sodic and saline sodic soils, which I'll discuss in a little while, lower high pH, low revegetation potential, compaction prone, wind prone, wind erosion prone, and severe water erosion prone, stony or rocky soils, and prime farmland. And these are all characteristics that would be important either for determining soil quality. These are all characteristics that would be important for determining soil quality and some aspects of constructability along the pipeline right-of-way.
Do you believe the tables and other information...
Could I expand a little bit more? I'd like to draw your attention to the second set of tables. I think there were a few surprises. I had a few surprises in these tables. There was a second page of tables that I provided that shows a centerline summary, and the centerline summary for the same types of limitations is provided by county, and this was something that was not done in the application. And again, the distribution of these soil limitations and soil properties are provided by county, and what I'd like to draw your attention to would be like the saline soils. They have the miles of saline soils with a total of 74.18 miles of saline soils would be expected to be encountered along the 313 miles right-of-way in South Dakota. They have a percentage of that. That's 23.6% of saline soils would be expected. Not very much sodic soil, but saline sodic soils would also account for a significant mileage along the corridor, and that would be 65.97. Total percentage would be around 45% of soils in saline or saline soda categories. The second example, and this is to show you how this information can be utilized by TransCanada and by the Public Utilities Commission in assessing environmental impacts and hazards along the right-of-way. On page 41 of the redline application, I draw your attention to the second paragraph where it indicates that there are scattered areas of saline or sodic soils known to occur in the project region, specifically around Butte County. And if you take a look at the table, they have not done this analysis to this level of detail in the application. Butte County has a relatively low crossing length, And there are other counties that have significantly more proportions of saline in silvic soils. They call them sensitive soils here, and that they would have low reclamation potential. And if you take a look at the last paragraph, again, they're talking about low reclamation potential soils. And the last sentence in that paragraph that continues on to page 42 indicates that the success of stabilization and restoration efforts in these areas, being saline and silvic soils, may be limited unless additional treatments and practices are employed to offset the adverse physical and chemical characteristics of the soils. Now, again, this does not mean TransCanada and Keystone, that this is going to be a significant problem, but it is going to have to be a problem that is addressed, and they are addressing it, and we'll be discussing that later on when we talk about their COMREC units.
I didn't hear that. We'll be discussing that later on when we talk about their what?
Their COMREC construction and reclamation units that they are proposing to be setting up in cooperation with the NRCS.
So do you believe then that these tables and this other information that you received does show the applicant has an understanding of the need for specific construction and reclamation to deal with this extreme variety of landform and soils?
Well, I do. In the application and in the construction mitigation and reclamation plan, there was really no mention made of the construction and reclamation units. But now they are proposing to develop construction reclamation units that can be utilized, basically mapped on the ground, to identify areas where there may be specific site-specific problems that they can basically adapt to their construction procedures to on a site-specific basis.
So then, well, a lot of the questions you had were because that information wasn't necessarily contained in the CMRP, the Construction Mitigation Reclamation Plan. You did just testify then that information, per the applicant's response to your question, will all be contained in these CONREC unit maps, and mm-hmm. you do believe that is sufficient, correct?
Well, they provided a summary of what they have considered their construction reclamation units to be. And it seems like it seems to me that it's very appropriate and a very good start. They are going to be collaborating with the NRCS, and I understand from Kara that they are in the process of doing that now. So they should be actually getting some local expert assistance in dealing with some of the more unique problems that there may be with construction in these particular areas. And what I would like to say is if I were going to define what a construction reclamation unit would be, is it would be a mapping unit that would have internally consistent soil characteristics, and these characteristics would respond similarly to construction. Those units may be combined with other units in a complex that would be repeating on the landscape. However, but those units would actually be a management unit that they could utilize to identify specific construction techniques as well as reclamation techniques that would be appropriate.
And do you have a recommendation then regarding those maps and whether they should be filed here at the PUC?
Well, the recommendation that I have in testimony and that I would provide to the commissioners is that the PUC basically make it a condition or a requirement that Keystone Limited Partnership provide its CONREC unit classification system and the corresponding pipeline milepost references for those units within South Dakota prior to construction, and that this classification system be prepared in accordance with an appropriate agency, which would be, in this case, the Natural Resource Conservation Service.
Do you have any further recommendations regarding alternate soil handling procedures?
Mm. Alternative soil handling procedures is something that has come up. It is not a universally accepted standard industry practice to do the type of things that I'm going to be discussing. However, it has been a requirement to adapt to specific soil quality issues in Wisconsin. and Minnesota, and as well as in Canada. And what I'm calling alternative soil handling procedures is also something that should not be thought of as being universally applicable to similar settings up and down the pipeline. It would be designed for particularly sensitive areas, very high-value agricultural areas, areas where a degradation of soil quality would be particularly important. And what I'm basically calling out for here is basically a triple lift, because there are several soils that have very dramatically different subsoil characteristics. So usually when you're doing most pipeline construction, you consider the topsoil to be the most valuable horizon. That's the one that is stripped and treated and segregated separately. And then there's the subsoil underneath that, which basically continues to the bottom of the trench. There are certain soils that have very poor quality subsoils that underlie much better quality subsoils. And in these particular situations, you may want to, in certain situations, treat these three separate entities to be segregated separately along the pipeline route. The examples that I have provided in testimony would be both physical and chemical characteristics, and the chemical characteristics have been primarily adapted in Canada. The work that has been done in Minnesota and in Wisconsin deals with a very strong textural discontinuity when there may be very coarse textures underneath fine textures. And so when you're doing the segregation during the pipeline construction process, you basically are mixing coarse and fine textures in the subsoil. And that can change the hydrologic characteristics and lower the plant productivity and the soil quality. The same type of a thing can happen when you have a lot of soluble salts, which basically complete with plants for water. And if you bring the zone of soluble salts up within the rooting zone, that would not be representative of a native soil, you may have problems with reclamation. And Keystone did recognize this in their application. I do think that they have probably more of this type of soil than they originally had thought. So the recommendations that I would have would be to basically incorporate that type of an analysis, taking a look at these very special soils in special settings where a decrease in soil quality would have a particularly negative impact, and incorporate those in these CONREC units or construction reclamation units.
There was some rebuttal filed by Mr. Schmidt, and just if you have any comments regarding what he did file.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Schmidt, again, the information that was provided in response to my queries in 3, which was comment response 3, the third set, was very good. The one question that I did have about something that Mr. Schmidt said, and it's on his rebuttal testimony, is he indicates that it's not really practical to try to identify these soils, and that you really can just take a look at the surface of the soil, and you can't really tell what's going on the subsurface. But again, if you take a look at these as applicable to very specific settings, some of which can be identified by land use and by the NRCS, there is technology right now that has been used for several years in precision agriculture, where they can go in and utilize a multifunction probe and probe the soil and determine the penetration resistance, the presence of paralithic shale. They can determine the salinity of the subsoil and various subsoil layers, in addition to several other characteristics. The probe is attached to a GIS unit and basically allows them to run right down the center line, taking samples every 100, 150 feet, and they can probably go through several miles in one day. This is something that has been done on several pipeline projects in Wisconsin, and it's probably more commonly associated with monitoring.
You specifically mentioned the presence of sodium bentonite and saline sodic soils could pose some challenges. If you could just tell us those, what the challenges are for those two types of soils, and just in layman's terms, what it means.
Sodium bentonite is a material that was recognized as being problematic in the application, and it's also been recognized as being problematic in a lot of the responses. And what it is it's a 2-to-1 expandable clay that is dominated. There are cations that are exchangeable on this clay. And when it's saturated with respect to sodium, when it gets wet, the sodium has a higher hydrated radius and it blows these particles apart. So the bentonite has a tendency to slake in water, becomes very greasy when it's wet, and then when it dries, it actually forms a crust. The sodium-affected soils that they would have problems with germination because of the crust on the surface. And the sodium bentonite, once it gets wet, can also serve as a slipping plane and allow for slumping. So the distribution of sodium bentonite is a particular issue. And when we get into the saline sodic soils, these are soils that are actually very common rain soils, and they are agricultural soils to a large degree, at least in North Dakota. And they are leached in the surface, and they have a sodium-affected layer in the middle, and then they have a very saline soil that is in the lower portion of the subsoil. And if these zones are mixed, again, you can have some problems because you bring the salts up into the rooting zone and creating conditions where you might have crop problems.
Specific then to sodium bentonite and the challenges that you just described, did the applicant accurately identify those challenges and list proper methods for dealing with them?
They did from the standpoint of construction. I believe they did. And in the response that they had in the third set of responses, they also did identify a suite of construction measures that could be utilized to minimize impacts and also mitigate impacts affected with saline sodic soils. So what we're really looking at here is the construction mitigation reclamation plan is kind of like a toolbox. And the con-rec units that are being developed, the way I perceive them, would be a mechanism to assist the applicant, which would be TransCanada, in utilizing the most appropriate construction technology to that particular situation.
The Sandhill region is another diverse area that the pipeline will cross. Are the applicant stated procedures for addressing the challenges in this area appropriate? And do you have any recommendations specific to these areas?
Well, when I was looking at the conservation or the construction mitigation and reclamation plan, it was one of the areas where they actually did identify a land-based unit called the Sandhills, where they called for specific training techniques and specific construction techniques to appropriately go through the area and minimize their impacts on natural resources. They had a series of bullets in the construction mitigation plan that dealt with how they were going to construct through there. I believe that what they had proposed is appropriate and probably could be used as a template for how they would address progressing through and constructing through several other areas in South Dakota where they may have not similar problems, actually would be quite different problems, but where they might be utilizing different construction techniques. And that might involve full topsoil stripping, partial topsoil stripping, or just trench-only topsoil stripping. Identifying areas where potential triple lift would be indicated due to the sensitivity of that area. So the Sandhills region, I thought that they did a good job on that. They didn't originally identify the specific soil types that they were concerned about. However, they did provide a large table that now does identify not only saline soils and wetland soils, but blowout soils and other areas that would be sensitive in that region.
So generally then, does it appear from your review that these CONREC units we've been referring to and proposed by the applicant do properly identify situations where site-specific procedures could be implemented to minimize the impacts and to facilitate restoration and reclamation?
I have not seen the system. I know that they are working on it, and I know that the plan is sound, and I think that their approach is sound. But again, I think that the structure that's being provided is a good one that will minimize impacts and actually result. What is the term? That there'll be the impacts will basically be acceptable for the purposes of this project.
Finally, anything else that you'd like to share with the commission? And if not, I'll turn you over for Cross.
Nothing more. Thank you.
Applicant, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I have no questions for Dr. Arndt at this point.
Okay. Dakota Rural Action.
Dr. Arndt. In your testimony, you noted that you evaluated certain sections of Keystone's application. You utilized your regional knowledge of soil characteristics and reviewed Keystone's responses to your data requests in preparing your testimony. Did you look at anything else?
I did take a look at their tables. I also took a look at several soil maps. There are a lot of resources for soils that are available on the internet. I did take a look at several of the soils that they have that are saline sodic. I did take a look at the distribution. I just basically did a very brief thumbnail QAQC of the tabulated data that they provided.
Did they one second. Could I please ask you to move the mic, especially when you're looking over that way, the mic's...
I have to move a lot of stuff.
Yeah, thank you. Yep, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt.
So you're doing a thumbnail. What were the abbreviations you used there? You said a thumbnail Q.
Oh, well, quality assurance, quality control. I basically looked at the table. I provided the comment to the PUC regarding my need for a little bit more data and also established how I would go about getting it, and then they provided the response. And this is... it's relatively new technology, and it's also technology that our firm developed in 1996 to deal with the StatsGo and also now with the Sergo, and so you really should have a soil scientist taking a look at the data.
Did they provide the data to you in electronic form or in hard copy?
They provided the data to me as basically hard copy from an Excel table.
Mm-hmm. Sort of along the lines of this as a hard copy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see. Looking at your qualifications, you've obviously been concerned and working with soils for a very long time here. And it seems that, trying not to summarize what you've been saying, but that there were some concerns you had that perhaps TransCanada's level of information wasn't detailed enough in some areas, that partially it has to do with how the quality of the analysis has to do with the amount of details provided for the analysis, and that TransCanada didn't provide in some areas as much detailed information as you would have preferred. Is that a fair... I'm trying to figure out a layman's way of saying some of the concerns that you had. Is that a fair generalization?
I think that's a fair assessment, but this whole process is an iterative process. Mm-hmm. They provided an application to PUC. PUC hired experts to take a look at the application, provide comments, so that TransCanada could then respond. So this is a process that works, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Are there is input from landowners on soil types and soil vulnerabilities or sensitivities a useful source of information in doing an analysis of this sort?
I would say that landowners, depending upon how much land they actually use and how intensively it's used, probably know their land better than anyone else. I have done soil investigations in the Dilts-Lysim area around Marmoth and in southwest. Dilts-Lysim, they're two different types of soils that have paralithic contact to shale. One's acid, one's basic or neutral pH. The landowners there are very aware of the capability of their land.
Did you talk to any landowners in preparation for your testimony today before the commission?
No, I had no opportunity to talk to landowners.
Did you review any of the comments provided at the public hearings from landowners expressing their concern with different soil issues on their lands?
No, I reviewed the application.
Okay. Did staff convey any of the information from the hearings to you?
The basic fact that they had hearings, no specific instances were brought up, and no specific soil quality-related issues were mentioned.
Okay. You also mentioned that you would, starting a number of things, you mentioned that the sandhill analysis was fairly good in your opinion, but other areas could benefit from the same level of analysis. Other parts of South Dakota along the route would benefit from a greater level of analysis, more like that was done for the sandhills. Could you describe what those areas are?
Well, the areas actually have, I have not done a analysis of the construction reclamation units that Keystone is working on. They are working with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and I'm sure they will be working with area soil scientists and possibly some local soil scientists who will have local expertise and local knowledge of these areas and these conditions.
Thank you. Are there these areas that you would personally recommend that some of the alternative soil handling procedures be applied in, or should that be applied for the entire line?
I think that is something that would be discussed with the Natural Resource Conservation Service.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it would be appropriate for to expect that an applicant would be doing triple lift soil handling procedures through the entire line. And one of the reasons for that is that there may be a requirement for additional workspace. There may be some trade-offs that have to be assessed for a given particular area. So if you do have to do triple lift, you have to have a space to put three lift soils. In a 110-foot right-of-way, there may be some space limitations, and they may require a wider right-of-way under those circumstances.
What your analysis has looked at is the quality of information that's available to TransCanada, that TransCanada has provided, and the amount of information that's been provided. Is access to information alone, does that guarantee that the soils will be treated properly during construction?
Well, there's going to be environmental oversight through environmental inspectors, and they, similar to what they would be in the Sandhills area, they would be trained. I would imagine that they would be trained in the specifics of the construction reclamation unit that they're going through and some of the particular considerations. The value of the data, as I said, it is equivalent to the level of detail in a county soil survey. And, I could go on for a long time about how soil surveys are done. But a lot of the soil map units that are provided in the county soil survey are complexes, and they contain more than one type of soil that might be dissimilar. And the Natural Resource Conservation Service estimates the percentage of the soil composition of these complexes. It does not indicate where they're going to be exactly, and that's something that would be dealt with on site during construction.
What regulatory agency is responsible for ensuring that construction is performed appropriately vis-a-vis soils?
I think that may call for a legal conclusion if you feel comfortable answering, but...
And I guess I would agree with that. In other states, it's the Department of Agriculture. In other states, they may have agricultural impact mitigation plans. In other states, they may have environmental monitors that are actually or have oversight and report to agencies. I do not know what the requirements are in South Dakota, but there will be an oversight that is indicated in the plans for environmental monitors, and I'm sure that the environmental monitors will be trained in how to handle construction through agricultural lands and rangelands.
Were you given any of the materials provided by landowners to the commission on what some landowners saw as improper construction techniques during used in the Keystone 1, Keystone East construction process? To review?
I have not been provided anything specific with Keystone East, but in any pipeline construction, there are going to be some controversies as to how land is taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
There is a process, again, in any pipeline construction where there is monitoring and there is compensation. So there's a legal process for a landowner if he believes that his land has been abused or that something hasn't gone right. That he can petition and find some recourse.
A lot of the, my understanding is that the reason for looking at, for reclamation is to ensure to limit soil erosion primarily and to ensure that the species of plants that grow there again or crop productivity is appropriate. Is that the core reasons for reclamation?
Well, reclamation, the reason for reclamation is to basically bring the soil back to the best condition that is practicable after construction.
Huh.
I don't think that anybody would think that you would be getting, if you're crossing an agricultural field after construction, 1 year after construction, you're going to be getting 100% of your original yield, which is one of the reasons why they compensate landowners generally on a sliding scale for their assumed impacts to yields that would be a result of pipeline construction.
And reclamation is part of that purpose for reclamation is to limit future soil erosion. Is that correct?
That would be one component.
Mm-hmm. As you may or may not be aware that the pipeline is, if it was constructed, would likely be constructed with a 4-foot depth of cover.
Mm-hmm. That's typical.
And so therefore, one of the reasons since erosion would remove soil, would it not, above the pipeline?
Well, that actually has been an issue in several other states that's been looked at.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the depth of cover that is required after construction is something that also is very landowner specific. So if you have a 4-foot depth of cover in Minnesota and you on a knob and you have a landowner that's basically plowing up and down the hill and isn't using wise conservation practices and allowing his hill to erode, you can have erosion that would go below the 4-foot depth of cover. I could see that happening in several circumstances.
Would depth of cover be only lost, though, where there are improper practices or farming practices? And remember that the life of the pipeline is projected to be around 50 years.
Now, this is outside the scope of direct testimony. We didn't include this in pre-filed testimony, so I'd make that objection.
Well, partially it's my own inability to remember exactly who testified. Somebody testified as to erosion, right? I honestly can't remember off the top of my head.
I would simply argue that it wasn't analyzed to the extent that now Cross is heading, but I anticipate that commissioners are interested in this information. I anticipate my objection won't be successful, but...
I mean, I think that...
Where I'm heading was just another question or so, and that was just to confirm that, mm-hmm. that one of the things that the witness did not examine was... the potential for soil erosion along the route on a milepost basis to result in a loss of depth of cover. And if the witness did not do that, that's fine. I just want to get that on the record that the witness didn't. So I guess my question was...
I did not analyze that.
Yeah, and that's all I'm asking for, is just to confirm that that was not reviewed and that, you know, I don't believe that staff analyzed the risk of loss of depth of cover over time to the pipeline. And if the witness wasn't asked to do that, that's...
The, I think counsel's testifying at this point, so if we could get back on track.
The objection is overruled. Please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. So just to, again, to restate, you did not analyze whether what the risk of loss of depth of cover would be to this pipeline from soil erosion anywhere along the route of the pipeline.
No, I did not.
Thank you. No more questions.
Thank you. Commissioners.
Dr. Arndt, when I look at your resume, I am reminded of William Shakespeare.
Much Ado About Nothing?
Very well done. I guess we could quote from a lot of his plays, couldn't we? No, a lot of people... Actually, it's a compliment, not a derogatory statement. A lot of people say they can't believe that he wrote as much as he did, that he was as prolific a writer and accomplished as much as he did. And when I look at your resume, I can't believe that one person has written and participated and done as much as you. And you've been extremely busy, and obviously we should take note of your expertise. I sincerely appreciate your testimony. I was especially interested in the, I believe you said, sodium bentonite, and you're talking about a cationic process and, somewhat familiar with that, having been in the water purification business and the anionic and cationic processes. And, I'd ask questions here. I don't know if you were here yesterday. Were you in the audience yesterday?
I was in the audience yesterday.
I was curious at that point about the laying of pipe and how they might get past cliffs and things of that nature. It was brought up by some of the landowners that as the route traversed through river areas and valleys, and there were some areas where there were cliffs, and they were wondering how they might get through those areas. Understanding that destabilization can take place with the movement of soils, even if they're somehow stacked back in the same order. Do you have concerns with that process?
As far as the stabilization of some of primarily it's probably tertiary sediments that would be dominated by the sodium bentonite. Usually they'll be layered, and if they're particularly steep, they probably won't be sodium bentonite. Sodium bentonite, when you take a look at the landforms that are created by the presence of the type of erosion that you have with sodium bentonite, you think of in some of the areas like maybe in the Badlands of North Dakota, where you'll see very rounded hills. The sodium bentonite, that erosional process, really doesn't hold a real steep slope very well, although it can, depending upon what's holding up the slope. If it's capped by sandstone, obviously it's going to form a butte and it's going to have steep slopes. Typically what pipeline construction will do, and again I can only speak from the experience that I have on other pipelines, but when they are going up steep slopes, they normally tend to follow the topography. But when they're going up and down, straight up and down a steep slope, they will vary the depth of cut that they have so that they can modify the angle that's actually required in the pipe bends. So typically at the sharpest angles for these slopes is where you're going to have a fairly significant trench and a deeper pipe. There are other things that they can do if they are having, in sodium bentonite areas, the trench may be filled back with shale that is paralithic, And it's not really hard rock, but it forms pieces, and that can conduct water. So if you don't put in trench breakers, you'll basically have preferential water flow along the trench. So I would imagine that in these situations, they would be putting in trench breakers to basically prevent that, which may be particularly important because the sodium bentonite is unstable when it's wet.
Thank you. So would it be fair to say then that there will be challenges? In essence, there could be significant challenges with the construction of the pipeline because of soils. However, they are not insurmountable by any means?
That's correct. I think that if they experience areas that are going to be really problematic, you have to understand that they're putting a pipeline in the ground and they don't want to put a pipeline in a place that has a poor chance for pipeline integrity. They would normally want to route around it. So in particularly steep areas that are affected by sodium bentonite and some of these other areas, I'm sure that they would be looking to make some modifications to go around areas simply because of the fact that the integrity of the pipe could be compromised at some time in the future.
Thank you. You had some suggestions, and as I read your testimony, in different areas you stated, no need to go and look at these, I don't believe. You stated, does not meet industry standards for presenting soil limitations along the pipeline right of way for the reasons described below, and then you describe a number of different challenges. And in the very end of your testimony, you state that Keystone has not yet identified specific areas requiring site-specific erosion and sediment control plans. Do you wish to comment further on those?
Site-specific erosion control plans, I think, would be called for, again, in areas where they are at a point where they really know exactly where they're going, and they have made the minor adjustments to avoid some of these features. And I'm sure that they're probably still in that process. Also, we have not really had a chance to take a look at the completed construction reclamation process that they're going through right now. I was very delighted to hear that they have already contacted the Natural Resources Conservation Service and that they will be working with them, because sometimes if you start that process too late, you won't get any response from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. So at this particular juncture, I'm sure that they'll be working collaboratively with them to identify areas that are going to be problematic.
Thank you very much. And again, I appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Other commissioner questions? Commissioner Kolbeck, do you have a question?
I just have two. Could you explain the problem with the clay again? When you said that the saline will collect more moisture and then expand and break, is that something that happens after it dries when it's in the trench, or what exactly would the problem? Would it shale off on top? Or
the definition of a saline affected soil is one that slakes, disperses when it's wet, and becomes hard and massive when it's dry. And it has to do with the way sodium hydrates when it gets wet. It ends up pulling in water, so it has a very large shell of water around the particular ion. And so when you have the sodium ions on the exchange site and it gets wet, the particles that are forming the soil structure in this particular unit, they just basically blow apart. And so that's called dispersion. That's also one of the reasons why drilling mud that they use in HDDs is primarily bentonite, because it's very easy to mix in water. If you take a calcium-saturated clay and try to mix it in water, it's going to be really hard.
Sure.
It's going to take forever, and it's going to be really lumpy. But a lot of the sodium-saturated bentonite will form a mud very quickly, and it's something that they can utilize.
Like with directional boring and...
Right.
Yes. Okay. That makes sense to me. But will the... Do you see any problems with this clay area, with the top of the soil? If it's done properly, could the erosion be mitigated to, you said, an acceptable level?
I think that it can be mitigated to a practicable level. I think that there, and this is something that has to be taken into consideration with the construction reclamation units, is where to apply certain construction measures. This is something that happens all the time. Like I can give a little anecdote. Hugh Bennett, who is associated in him and another fellow named Kellogg, are actually basically from North Dakota. He was the first head or leader of the Soil Conservation Service. And he had a deputy that was from New York, and they went out for a trip into North Dakota, and the fellow from New York was just astonished that the people out there had let erosion go to the point where it was just amazing. And so I guess what I'm saying is that erosion is a natural feature on this landscape. And I don't think anybody should expect that they're going to prevent erosion in a landscape where every time you get 2 inches of rain, if you're in the backcountry, you need skis to get out, and you're getting an awful lot of sediment that's going into the coulees and the draws. It's a natural process, sure. And a very significant natural process in these areas.
And you had mentioned you did not study something that Mr. Blackburn had asked you. Could you? I didn't catch that last part of that conversation. You had not looked at what?
Well, what Mr. Blackburn was talking about is there is a requirement for depth of cover.
Okay.
And the Keystone TransCanada are utilizing 4 feet of cover, which is traditional. That's the normal amount of depth of cover. And that when you get into a situation where there's a strong amount of erosion going on, you might be able to, if it gets extreme, you might even be able to have the pipeline exposed. I don't see that as being real significant. I think it's probably more of a potentially significant issue in areas where they're cultivating and they're probably doing some deep ripping to decompact. And normally that's not going to happen on hill slopes, but if the pipeline depth of cover is reduced in an agricultural area and it goes from 4 feet to 2 feet, you can have some problems.
Okay. Still, okay. I see what you're getting at. All right. Thank you. First, just a clarification question. Did you prepare a couple of clarification questions? Did you prepare the summary sheet on the second page that was handed out?
That came from, I requested that information, mm-hmm. and it came from Keystone.
Okay. Were you able to see the work within these charts? I mean, were you able to see what the formulas were, essentially?
What they did, I requested that they provide the definitions for the limitations, and they did do that.
Okay.
And that was one minor exception, and that was actually the depth to the restrictive layer, because there's lots of restricted layers that are in the database. But the dominant ones are paralithic and lithic, and I did take a look at an example database, and virtually all the restrictive layers are paralithic.
Sure. So in your testimony, you note that originally the applicant did not provide sufficient information or organization to identify the location, magnitude, and type of soil-related limitation. I think in your testimony you then explain that by and large those insufficiencies were corrected through further information exchange.
They were.
Did the insufficiency in the original application put up any red flags of concern to you beyond just the fact that the information wasn't there?
It was typical. I was surprised to not see the information broken down by county. It was broken down by state. And there were several limitations that, again, I would have been concerned with that weren't present there that I'd identified to them.
Were those omissions, were they so severe as to raise concern in your mind as to whether or not, I mean, these folks knew what they were doing enough to build a pipeline?
No, not at all. One of the things that actually is continuing to amaze is the amount of progress that's going on with geographic information systems and information systems in general. And there are a lot of people, a lot of pipeline contractors, and a lot of pipeline companies that really aren't aware of some of the technology that's available. Now, a lot of it was developed with precision agriculture. So in precision agriculture, the landowner basically does what's called an Order 1 soil survey, where they map what's called a consociation, which means one particular soil series. And then they continually monitor yields on that particular area. So in people that are involved in that or that have yield monitors and know their soils, they pretty much know what kind of yields they're getting off of their ground.
So at some point, I think you said, I'm going to try to paraphrase your testimony, so correct me to the extent that I'm wrong. You mentioned that the integrity of the pipe could potentially be compromised in areas with high sodium bentonite content. Is that right?
If it's subject to slump, I think that those are areas that are going to have to be, you know, if they go through them and they can't avoid them, that is a condition that will have to be considered.
Okay.
You know, because anybody that if you see along the sides of the rivers, you'll see slump. If you take a look at the sides of the Missouri River around here, you'll see signs of slumping.
To go, and you're probably aware that, you know, the commission can't, in a formal way, route a pipeline route, but are there particular soil characteristics where you would say, boy, person really shouldn't put a pipeline there? If they can avoid it, here are the places they really shouldn't go through.
And I would expect that the NRCS, who they are cooperating with in the development of these CONREC units, would basically be able to do that. I could give them a first shot by just taking a very detailed look, which I have not done.
And I'm not talking about specific areas. I'm talking about general characteristics. I mean, what would you tell me if you were going to give me the 3-minute, you know, lecture on, boy, here are the soil, here are the areas you really want to avoid in general? Anything come to mind?
Areas that, you know, basically that are dominated by sodium bentonite that are very steep, if they can be avoided.
You note, I think you did a good job in your testimony of explaining some of the particular areas of concern with regard to South Dakota soils. They would include soils with restrictive layers, steep slopes, high pH, and highly wind and water erodible soils. Is this mixture of, you know, risk factors or soil vulnerabilities unique to South Dakota? Are there some best practices or some standard operating procedures that should be in place to deal with this set of risk factors above and beyond what would normally be encountered in other locales?
Well, again, what they're doing with their construction, mitigation, and reclamation plan is it's built-in flexibility, so that if they're doing erosion control, one of the important things that they can vary is the spacing of the erosion controls. So if you're in a highly erodible area and you're looking at water bars, it's what type of erosion control measure you use, which is listed in the conservation reclamation plan, and what the spacing may be. So the only thing that I saw that was not provided in the construction mitigation reclamation plan was the accommodation of this potential for triple lift. And again, I think that it's very expensive, and it also requires a lot of site-specific analysis. But I think that there are areas where it's probably something that they would want to have in their toolbox.
Well, the reason I'm asking, you know, Dr. Arndt, is that we've heard from a number of landowners that their particular area, their particular spot of range ground is highly and perhaps even uniquely erodible. I don't know enough to say whether that is the case or not. I mean, given your 25 years in this arena, I mean, is it likely that there are areas that are uniquely erodible for which the management techniques you've described will be insufficient?
There probably are some areas that are going to be like that.
And in those instances, the pipeline would need to be rerouted, or what would your professional recommendation be?
My professional recommendation would be to adapt the conditions of the construction mitigation reclamation plan to ensure, to the extent practical, that the area gets reclaimed. Probably the best thing to do is to ensure that there are some method for revegetating an area that's susceptible to erosion. But if it is in an area where chemistry or some other soil property prevents revegetation, and there could be very many of those. There are a lot of other different types of physical erosion controls that they can implement in those areas.
You have worked on a number of pipeline projects and for a variety of different, you know, folks who are paying the bills at the federal level and on the state level. I mean, are you familiar with, on any of the projects you've worked with, where 10 or 15 or 20 years after the fact, it was plainly evident that a pipeline had gone through that area, meaning that the reclamation activities that were undertaken were insufficient to return the area to you know, practically useful or and similar to the way it was found?
If you take an aerial photo, if you take a look at an aerial photograph of Wyoming, where they've got a lot of pipelines going through, you'll see areas that have not revegetated similarly to adjacent areas. I believe that it would probably be somewhat naive to assume that within 2 or 3 years you're going to get revegetation to the point that you have off right of way. There may be areas where revegetation is impossible. If you go out to northwestern or southwestern North Dakota, or the area around Harding County, there's a lot of bald spots and slick spots that aren't vegetated naturally, and they're going to be going through those. So the expectation that they're going to revegetate one of those areas is, again, it's not going to happen.
In those, and I know every area is going to have, you know, you've recommended that, you know, these CONREC units be analyzed, and it's almost as though there's a spot-by-spot plan, for dealing with these situations. But in general, from a bigger picture perspective, that in those types of areas where revegetation will be very difficult, are there things the commission needs to be keeping in mind?
That's probably true. This is greenfield. This is greenfield where there's no existing pipe. But it's an arid area. Revegetation, I mean, if you're going to get 14 to 18 inches of rain in a dry year is 10, establishing vegetation is going to be difficult.
And you spoke, I mean, you talked about 2 or 3 years, you know, it would be tough to expect. But looking longer term, I mean, in the short term, I think there's some understanding expectation that the applicant would have the resources to be able to make people whole with that. But let's look long term. Let's look out mm-hmm. a couple, 3 decades. Are there instances where you can just tell a pipeline came through and it continues to cause problems with regard to vegetation or sloping of the land or soil types or were not put back in the right way?
Sure. And one of the reasons for that is 3 decades ago, they didn't do topsoil stripping. They didn't do decompaction. They didn't do soil segregation. There are several, I'm aware of several scientific studies, actually the best of which come out of Canada, where they have investigated the long-term reclamation potential of pipelines in relationship to the type of restoration process that was used at a particular time. And originally when they went through, if they didn't do any topsoil stripping, they didn't do any soil segregation, and they didn't do any decompaction, they're getting yield reductions that go out 10, 15 years. But the latest research, at least in the agricultural areas, is showing that with the methods that actually came into being when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission started providing their plan and procedures and they started utilizing topsoil stripping, they did have environmental mitigation and they had environmental inspection. They had wet weather shutdown, which is one of the more important things that a pipeline can do. That the revegetation of the lands that would be utilized for cropping, for intensive agriculture, that they are getting the reestablishment of pre-construction yields, meaning maybe 90% of the off-right-of-way yields, is occurring within 4 or 5 years.
So you're testifying that the reclamation approaches and techniques being used today are significantly more sophisticated than what was being used a few decades ago?
Absolutely. Just the idea of depth of cover. I'm familiar with a pipeline in Minnesota that pipelines that were installed 30 years ago, if they went through a wetland, what they basically did is they laid the pipe on the top of the wetland and then covered it up with peat. So the techniques are continuing to improve as the technology to do the environmental assessments prior to the siting of the pipeline continue to improve. The equipment continues to improve. We've been talking about these SCADA systems. Those are relatively new, and it's fairly high technology and very appropriate technology.
You testified that erosion is a significant natural process. I mean, are you aware of other pipeline projects that have gone to a standard depth of cover of greater than 4 feet in highly erodible areas?
I believe that they have done that in some places in northern Illinois. This is corn and soybean country, and the cost per acre is probably on the order of $3,000 to $4,000. But they have gone to some deeper depths of cover. But again, what you're talking about, everything that you do is a trade-off. If you go to a deeper depth of cover, you end up going to a deeper trench. You're going to have more storage. You're going to have more disturbance. And any of the gentlemen from Keystone, I mean, they've built lots of pipelines. And one of the things that's kind of an axiom of construction is that there's a whole series of trade-offs to basically any activity that you're doing.
You described this process as an iterative process and a process that works. Should this commission have any concern that I know the thorough CONREC units are being done right now? Should this commission have any concern that you haven't reviewed them prior to your testimony today? You haven't had that opportunity.
I have not had that opportunity, but again, I have several friends in the NRCS, and that's something how the condition is written by the commission for these CONREC units, there might be some leeway there that could give you an opportunity to take a look at them. But again, I think that just the evidence that I've seen is that TransCanada has been very, very responsive to my questions, and I think that they are probably going to work effectively with the Natural Resource Conservation Service in the development of these units.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up just a sec, if I might, on Chairman Johnson's question there. Would it be your thought, and again, your condition was fairly clear in that you would like the CONREC, as I understand it, details provided to the commission prior to commencement of construction. Is that a fair statement? And just following up on where I think Commissioner Johnson was going, ought that then be subject to some form? I mean, for us to get them, in order to attain any value from that, that implies that we perform some form of review of those, right, and have some opportunity to weigh in with if we see something that we think are deficiencies or flaws. Would it be your recommendation that we have some kind of review by somebody that knows what they're doing, like yourself, and then have the ability at least to comment or maybe even have some kind of review approval process of that?
Well, legally, I do not know what type of requirements or restrictions the commission would be operating under.
Mm-hmm.
It was my understanding that basically what you do is that you could require them to be provided prior to construction. beyond that, I don't know what type of conditions you could put on there.
Right.
But you do have the, obviously you have the opportunity to receive, or you're going to be receiving the COMREC units mm-hmm. prior to construction, and that you certainly would have the opportunity to comment. How any deficiencies that you perceive get resolved, I don't know how that would happen.
Okay. But, I mean, the legal issue, again, you're not a lawyer, and the extent of the, that's an argument all of us counsel, or the counsel can have at some point. But from a practical standpoint, would it be useful or valuable, I guess, for those CONREC detail plans, once they're completed, as they become completed, to be submitted, and then for the commission, using the resources, hopefully, of a professional to review those? And
I would think there would be some value to that, yes.
Okay. I mean, that's not something the NRCS itself would do, right? They would, their input would be on the input side, working with TransCanada to develop those detailed plans.
That's the way I perceive the process to be.
Okay, thank you. Now, one last thing, and that's with respect to, you mentioned the probing. Did I hear that right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's that, a soil probe? Is that like a rod you stick down the ground?
It's
or
a rod you stick
like
down the ground that has several sensors that can determine a lot of the most important soil parameters that you'd be looking at. Just to give you an example, there was much made in the application about compaction. Compaction is something that is dependent upon moisture content, and it's very easy to do moisture content with these probes now. Identification of underlying paralithic or lithic material is something that's very easily done. And also taking a look at the salinity. So you can just shoot the probe down one time and you get all that information. It's mounted on a four-wheel drive gator, and they can just, you know, like go right down the center line. These companies that actually have this equipment routinely do this for areas that are involved with precision agriculture.
Is the term precision agriculture, is that like a term of art in the in your line of work, or is that isn't a company name or anything like that?
No, it's actually a term. It's a subscience of agronomy now.
Okay,
to tell you the truth, there are landowners that basically are utilizing GPS equipment mm-hmm. and Order 1 soil surveys and satellites in order to fertilize their fields by soil type.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually plug it into the fertilizer and their tractors, and they go down the field, and the equipment tailors the fertility to the soil type and what they got last year for yield.
Sure.
So it's fairly high technology.
I think, yeah, one of the jobs the commission has here is regulating elevator companies, and I know that wheat growers and some of those do that work for a living. I know that's one of their lines of work that's growing, I know, a lot. Well, just one last question on the probing then is, you know, you were here for the testimony relative to paleontological resources,
mm-hmm.
and sort of the focusing of the areas where more stringent monitoring, if you want to call it that, would be undertaken by the company. And those areas have been outlined via a survey done by an outside party.
Mm-hmm.
Is that same kind of narrowing of the field doable, or should it be done in order to, if the commission decided this probing is something that was a useful idea to include in what we do here, is that something pertinent to the entirety of the route, or is that something that could be limited with respect to certain areas where lithic or paralithic or some of the other more problematic condition types might be present?
I had visualized this as being something that would be site-specific towards sensitive areas on this route. However, there are, and I will bring up Canada and Alberta. Alberta requires Order 1 soil surveys in all the agricultural areas that they have pipelines going through. It's an additional expense. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But it is also not standard industry practice, certainly in the United States.
Thank you. Any other commissioner questions? Staff, do you have a redirect?
I just had one clarification. Did you review the PHMSA special permit?
No,
instructed by staff? So then you'd have no reason to doubt it if I told you that federal code normally requires 3 feet of cover, the special permit requires 4, and is enforceable by PHMSA.
I have no reason to disagree.
Maybe could I have you respond to that with the mic a little closer?
I have no reason to disagree.
Thank you. And in, again, like we've been doing, so that you guys get a chance, the other two counsel, to follow up on the commissioner's questions, I'm going to give you another bite at the apple here.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I do have a couple of follow-up questions. Dr. Arndt, related to the question that Ms. Semler just asked you, similarly, are you aware that condition number 20 of the special permit granted by PHMSA for the Keystone Pipeline required 48 inches of cover for that pipeline?
No, I was not aware of that.
And are you aware that Keystone proposes 48 inches of cover for the Keystone XL pipeline?
That I am aware of, yeah.
With respect to the issue of landowner involvement in the issues that are addressed by the construction reclamation units, you reviewed Dr. Schmidt's rebuttal testimony, is that correct?
I did.
And in paragraph 10 of his rebuttal testimony, he indicated that Keystone would develop the CONREC units in consultation with the NRCS and would then discuss with landowners the proposed CONREC units to take account for best farm management practices and any particular insider information that landowners have.
This is an excellent idea.
You think that is appropriate?
Yes.
As a follow-up then, would it be appropriate for the Public Utilities Commission in considering the CONREC units that are developed by TransCanada to rely on the NRCS, which has local expertise with the particular soils involved, to determine whether the CONREC units have been appropriately involved rather than for the PUC itself to try to determine that?
The NRCS would have, the NRCS has the expertise. If they go to the state soil scientist, he's probably not going to know very much. If they go to the area soil scientist, he's going to know an awful lot. And, there may be a residual soil survey group in some areas. So again, I think that Keystone has already contacted the NRCS and you will probably identify the area, the person with the greatest expertise.
But you're satisfied that some person with the NRCS has the appropriate expertise to determine whether the CONREC units are appropriate for the purpose for which they're intended?
I believe so, yes. Even in range areas, there's a lot of involvement with the NRCS in range. BLM may have more, but I don't believe there's any BLM land that's being traversed.
One last question. Commissioner Johnson asked you about one thing that you would definitely recommend in terms of construction and whether there are areas to avoid, and you mentioned steeply sloping soils with bentonite. Did you hear testimony yesterday that, in fact, that was one of the considerations that TransCanada looked at in routing the pipeline and made an effort to avoid those areas?
I believe it was Heidi's testimony, and I also believe that they were looking at flyovers, which would give them even a better idea of what's actually going on. The soil survey certainly has identified an awful lot of steeply sloping areas as well. But these are areas that were just minor adjustments. And, again, I don't know what your full approved right-of-way is, but minor adjustments can solve an awful lot of problems.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Mr. Blackburn.
Doctor, you haven't studied the depth of cover issue or soil erosion along the entire pipeline, as you testified before, but you offered an opinion that you didn't think it would be that big of a problem here.
I said what I had indicated, that it would be a larger problem in areas where there is intensive farming and potential for decompaction, because some of the decompaction equipment rippers may go down 2 feet, and I've seen them actually going down 4 feet. And obviously, if you have a pipeline that is losing its depth of cover, tillage is much more of an issue. I think that if there is a problem with this in rangeland, then that's something that's going to be captured. Excuse me, that's going to be captured by the flyovers and the operations during the operations period. So these pipelines, once they're put in, they normally routinely go through several flyovers, several flyovers a year. So they would be able to identify areas, where they might be losing depth of cover. And again, it's not to the pipeline's advantage. The pipeline does not want to lose depth of cover and have an exposed pipe. And if they have an exposed pipe, I'm sure that they're going to have some contingencies that are going to rectify that situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know that for certain. But I'm sure that you would be able to find that information.
You had also mentioned that you'd heard of other problems in other states where pipelines had lost depth of cover. How many examples of that are you aware of from your personal experience?
There were one or two instances in some older pipelines in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And in Wisconsin, they have loess soils. I don't know if you're familiar with soils, but loess is a very highly erodible soil. And when it's subject to poor management practices, can erode quite rapidly. And there were areas where they had lost depth of cover.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard of any that was due to in an agricultural area in loess soils?
What's that?
That was in agricultural areas in loess soils, or was that in non-agricultural areas?
In agricultural area.
Yeah. Thank you. You also mentioned that wet weather shutdown was important. Could you describe a bit more about why wet weather shutdown is important?
That was specifically in regards to rutting and compaction. As far as compaction goes, if the soils are dry, the soil particles basically lock together, and compaction is not that much of an issue. When soils are completely saturated, again, because water is incompressible, generally, soil compaction is not that much of an issue. Soil compaction is an issue when the soils are moist. And wet weather shutdown would be something that would be done, and I believe that it's in the construction and reclamation mitigation plan that Mr. Hargrove is going to discuss later. But wet weather shutdown occurs when basically the construction is adversely affecting the productivity of the soil, where they could be getting excessive compaction and where they could be getting rutting and soil mixing.
And would that excessive compaction happen at the entire depth of the trench? I mean, in other words, it wouldn't be, it seems like it might be possible to decompact the topsoil that was replaced if it wasn't put in wet, but that even there, lower in the trench, if the soils were returned deeper in the trench during wet weather conditions, that the soil could be compacted from the top all the way down to the bottom of the
trench. Compaction in the trench is generally not a problem. The compaction that occurs associated with pipeline construction is a feature primarily of the working side where all the equipment is trafficking. Mm-hmm. If anything, the trench areas have the opposite problem, where they will, because the way the soil goes in, and a lot of times the contractors will attempt to compact the soil to the extent that they can. You know, but they still end up having a trench that will, for a period of time after construction, hold an awful lot of water, which is one of the reasons why they put in water bars if they're on steeply sloping areas, because they get preferential flow of water in the macropores that are present in the trench. So when we talk about compaction as being an issue, it's primarily an issue associated with equipment trafficking on the working side.
Thank you. You also mentioned that the depth of trench, how deep a trench should be, is something of a trade-off, that, you know, the deeper you go, you know, there may be advantages to the pipe, but on the other hand, it also requires greater construction area. And as Ms. Semler mentioned, this pipe will be a foot deeper than the standard, which is 3 feet. Could you describe what the difference would be in terms of construction impact from having a trench be a foot deeper, be at a 3 foot level as opposed to a 4 foot level?
You would have a deeper trench and you would require more construction right away in order to store the soil. Depending upon how much topsoil there would be, you would have topsoil segregation and subsoil segregation. So, and again, this is one of those trade-offs where you have a limited construction right-of-way, and it's specifically limited. There's a lot of activity that goes on in a construction right-of-way in a pipeline. And what they're doing is they actually minimize the right-of-way length or width to the extent in order to minimize impacts to the environment or to agricultural land or whatever. So if you're going into an area where you're requiring 3 or 4 lifts and you have to keep that material separate, you're going to have to increase your width because you're just not going to have enough width to get the equipment in and to get everything done.
To go a foot deeper, would the impacts, I mean, from a layperson's point of view, you go from a 3 foot depth to a 4 foot depth, you increase the volume proportionally, but is the construction impacts, do they actually increase? The deeper you go, the greater the construction impacts relative to the depth. So going from 3 feet to 4 feet, one could say, well, that's another foot deeper, so the construction impacts would be a third greater. Then
what specific construction impacts are you addressing?
How wide the right-of-way is, and as you said, having a greater need for storing trench materials, the soils, along the right-of-way.
I believe that they have established a 110-foot right-of-way for this pipeline,
right,
in upland areas and narrower in wetland areas, again, to reduce impacts. If you're asking me if I think there are going to be more construction-related impacts with a deeper trench, I would say no. You know, for some of the reasons that you yourself had already indicated, that you're getting a deeper depth of cover in areas where there's a possibility for erosion.
So you're saying, I didn't say safety though, so you're saying that a deeper depth of trench would not result in greater construction impacts?
Well, again, I don't know exactly what you're getting at. Greater construction impacts is they're going to be there for slightly longer in order to dig the trench. Mm-hmm. They're going to require slightly more right-of-way in order to accommodate the extra foot of dirt, but that's not that significant. I don't think that the construction-related impacts would be that much more significant. But then again, I don't know the reason for the increased depth. I've not talked to anyone at Keystone for that reason.
Yeah, and I'm not asking what the reasons are for going a foot deeper, just simply what the construction impacts would be. So at a minimum, you would need to dig out an additional foot of material and place that outside of the trench.
If you're going an extra foot deeper, that's correct.
Right. And that material would require additional space at the top of on the side of the trench for storage because there's more material.
I don't think that they're going to be asking for additional right-of-way over what they've already asked for. I think that that's all been involved with the plan.
Yeah, they've asked for the right-of-way knowing that they would do a 4 foot depth of cover. So, I mean, it's not really that they, you know, had a 3 foot, now they're going to do 4 foot suddenly. They've always planned for a 4 foot depth of cover is my understanding. So let's see. The NRCS is a federal agency, that's correct?
That's correct. It's very state-oriented, though.
And the resources to assist and work with TransCanada and the landowners through this process would be provided by the federal government?
That I do not know. I have not made the NRCS contact. The NRCS is an agency that is designed to help people that are involved with land use projects. Most of the time they're associated with, you know, doing agriculture. And they'll have farm plans. And they'll have another agency, like the Farm Services Agency, which will be involved with a slightly different aspect of agriculture. But the NRCS has engineers And they have several technical experts that would be capable of providing the type of assistance that they would have to develop these CONREC units that would be primarily focused on soil issues.
And that would that be a substantial task for NRCS to do that in this for this pipeline?
Again, I it would be a task. I don't know how it would be arranged, and I have no knowledge of what arrangements Keystone has made with the NRCS. I don't know.
Yeah, Commissioner Johnson had discussed how NRCS would implement this, and of course there's some conversation about the timing of all that. And what I'm getting at is simply, it's one thing to say that NRCS will do this or should do this or may do this. It's another thing, it's a different thing when it actually happens, whether they in fact do this properly and have the time and resources to, do things right. And it sounds like you're saying that you don't have an opinion about their resources, their capability of doing it, or the resources they have to do this fully, this project fully. But that's not within your opinion.
Yeah, I think we're getting outside the scope of not only the direct testimony, but commissioner clarification questions, which is the point we're at right now. We're not analyzing.
Yeah, I really can't speak for the NRCS.
Yeah. I said we're not here to analyze NRCS's abilities.
Well, the commission is relying heavily on NRCS participation in this, and I think the landowners are also wanting to make sure that it isn't just empty promises and that there really are the resources and the capabilities to go to the level of detail that would protect landowners. And you may not have a direct experience or knowledge of that, and that's fine. Just wanted to know whether you had an opinion about whether they had the resources to fulfill the commitments that I think people are expecting them to fulfill.
Before Dr. Arndt answers, I mean, I do think we have an objection, and I just also want to state that I don't think the conversation or the questions that I was asking Dr. Arndt specifically related to NRCS. I just want to clarify that.
Sorry if I miscarried. I thought I had, but
you didn't upset me. I just want to make clear for the record. So.
Well, I think I understand the point you're trying to make, and I'm going to let you. Maybe could we just cut to the chase as quick as we can?
That was my last question.
Okay, fire away then. Go ahead. Can you answer?
I can't definitively answer, but I have enough friends in the NRCS in North Dakota and other places around the state that have been extremely helpful on both large and small projects. And they have even been helpful on residential developments in the Twin Cities area. The NRCS is a service agency. That's basically what they're around for. They may make some arrangements with payment. I don't know that. I really don't. And I can't really address it.
Thank you.
Additional questions, Mr. Blackman?
No more questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any follow-up by staff? Is your witness?
I have no further questions.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Moore, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. May I follow up on one issue raised by Mr. Blackburn in his questions?
Sure.
Dr. Arndt, Mr. Blackburn asked you a number of questions related to depth of cover and the loss of depth of cover through various activities like deep tilling of the soil. I know you testified that you're not familiar with the special permit conditions imposed by PHMSA on the Keystone Pipeline, but I want to read you two of those conditions and ask if they address the issue that was raised. In condition number 20, the special permit says, in areas where the pipeline is susceptible to threats from chisel plowing or other activities, the top of the pipeline must be installed at least 1 foot below the deepest penetration above the pipeline. If routine patrols indicate the possible loss of cover over the pipeline, Keystone must perform a depth of cover study and replace cover as necessary to meet the minimum depth of cover requirements specified herein. Are those conditions appropriate to address the issues that you discussed with depth of cover?
Yes, they are.
Thank you. That's all I have.
May I ask one follow-up question on that?
Please, yes.
The review that Council for TransCanada just mentioned was flyover with a jet helicopter. And are all soil erosion events such that you can determine, you can identify soil erosion, including long-term or chronic soil erosion, from a jet helicopter at, say, 200 feet?
Yes.
So, okay. And that's all the questions I have.
Okay.
Are we, staff, you don't have anything, do you? Any follow-up?
No.
We've been at it here quite a while. I think we'll give our reporter a break. And why don't we take a 10-minute or so recess and reconvene at 20 after 3 by that clock up there, anyway.
Right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Welcome. Could you please introduce yourself to the commission?
My name is Ross Hargrove. I work for the Natural Resource Group. My business address is 1000 IDS Center, 80 South 8th Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55402. My educational background is that I received a Bachelor of Science degree in Forest Resource Management from the University of Minnesota. Since the year 2000, I've worked for the Natural Resource Group and in roles as a consultant and manager of our operational compliance group. My specific job duties include acquiring permits for various pipeline expansion and maintenance and operation projects, drafting construction mitigation plans, environmental inspection supervision, environmental compliance management, and authoring of sections of EISs for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and topics such as land use impacts, vegetation, and transportation.
Did you write and submit pre-filed testimony for this matter?
Yes, I did.
And did you write and submit some supplemental testimony?
Yes, I did.
And if you were asked all those questions with those changes made in the supplemental testimony, would you answer them all the same today?
Yes, I would.
And they are in front of you as Exhibit 5 and 6. Overall, now I'll back up. What portion of the application did you review?
I reviewed the portion of the application that is considered as the TransCanada's construction mitigation reclamation plan.
And overall, was that plan consistent with industry best practices?
In general, I would agree to that statement. What I did as part of my review is I compared that document to documents that have been prepared by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. These documents include their upland erosion, revegetation, and maintenance plan, and wetland and water body construction mitigation procedures. These plans are applicable to the construction of natural gas pipelines, but they are very relevant to review of TransCanada's construction, reclamation, and mitigation plan.
We heard a lot of in previous testimony about the construction reclamation mapping units. Do you have anything addition to share or any other recommendations regarding those aside from what's previously been entered into the record?
No. Dr. Arndt's testimony, I believe, covered most of my comments on that. I do recommend that it be submitted to the Public Utilities Commission prior to construction.
Some of the questions that you asked throughout the discovery process went towards TransCanada's plan to deal with crop loss with those landowners along the route. Is their plan adequate?
TransCanada's intention, I think, is pretty clear to compensate landowners fairly for potential impacts on crop loss. It is my opinion that a more structured crop monitoring program may be appropriate for the project, one in which they offer the opportunity to landowners to participate in a program that allows for two or more years of crop monitoring to be conducted on their property to adequately determine if restoration is progressing.
After your analysis of the original application, you had several questions that went specifically towards a frack-out plan, and the company did submit what they have. Tell us about what we received and your opinion regarding that plan.
TransCanada provided a frack-out plan, which is, it appears to be applicable to the entire pipeline project. My recommendation is that TransCanada provide a plan that is more specific to the state of South Dakota and more specific to the horizontal directional drill crossings to be conducted within the state.
There also were some questions regarding adverse weather plans. Do you have a position on their answer to those questions?
Yes. In Mr. Hicks' testimony, rebuttal testimony to my earlier testimony, he clarified that TransCanada's wet weather shutdown procedures would apply in all agricultural lands and not just cultivated agricultural lands. And he also identified some language in the previous Keystone Pipeline Project order, which clarifies of when wet weather shutdown would be appropriate. And that language satisfied my concerns.
In your supplemental testimony, you made some changes to the CMRP review that you did. If there's any specific explanation of those changes that you'd like to share with the commission, please do that at this time.
Mr. Hicks provided a rebuttal testimony, and in my revised testimony, I tried to address many of the questions that he had or provided clarifications where I thought appropriate. Many of these changes are primarily wording or qualifying certain statements. Just to kind of run through a summary of those changes is the first one is on Section 3.0 of the document entitled Construction Mitigation Reclamation Plan Review. I elaborated on what I believe to be the industry standards for refueling and spill prevention in the vicinity of wells. My previous testimony had omitted the Federal Energy Regulatory's common guidance for refueling and storage of fuels near private wells, so I added that text. I also qualified some statements regarding when decompaction should occur when using the full right-of-way topsoil segregation method. I added that decompaction, or ripping as you would say, be completed a second time if the topsoil is replaced under wet or moist soil conditions, or if the right-of-way continues to be used as a travel lane following replacement of the topsoil. I revised the Section 4.7 trenching and alternative soil handling methods to be consistent with Jim Arndt's testimony, which has been previously discussed. In several sections, I added language to provide some flexibility for cleanup to TransCanada in areas that may be delayed for because of weather conditions. and I made other changes kind of throughout the document that were appropriate that Keystone had identified.
No further questions.
Applicant.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Hargrove, my name is William Taylor, and I represent TransCanada. I just have a few questions for you, actually clarifications of the points that you raised in your revised testimony. First, I'd like to talk to you for a moment about spill containment issues. In your original testimony, you suggested that TransCanada be prohibited from fueling activities or fuel storage activities within 400 feet of a domestic water well. In your revised testimony, you suggested 200 feet from a private water well, 400 feet from municipal wells, but most importantly, rather than saying prohibited, you suggest that TransCanada avoid or minimize those activities. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And you understand, of course, that fuel storage most typically is done at some distance away from where the equipment is located during the construction process, as opposed to refueling activities which are done where the equipment is located.
That's correct.
And so fuel storage is much easier to locate more than 400 feet away, right?
Yes.
You don't suggest that refueling activities should not be undertaken within the right-of-way, only that TransCanada should be alert to the locations of private water wells and try and minimize refueling activities near them.
That is correct.
Thank you. Now, the soil segregation issue that has been discussed, first of all, you accede to Dr. Arndt's testimony, is that correct?
Yes.
As to the soil segregation issue, you say in your testimony that you encourage TransCanada to work closely with landowners. Are you aware of the what TransCanada calls the binding construction agreement arrangement that it enters into with landowners?
I'm not familiar with it at this time.
Perhaps it's expressed differently in TransCanada's writings. It's a process by where each landowner is offered the opportunity to suggest what type of topsoil stripping and topsoil removal he wants of three different designs, and the landowner is also asked about any unusual or unique characteristics of his land and how that should be specially treated, and then TransCanada in effect contracts with the landowner to comply with an agreed upon set of conditions. You think that's a wise and prudent method for TransCanada to proceed with the landowners?
I do. In my testimony and in that document regarding review of the construction mitigation plan, I did point out several pros and cons of each method. But I recognize that the appropriate topsoil segregation method, it's a very considered on a site-by-site basis, and I believe that input from the landowner is very important.
And ultimately, it should be the landowner's choice in the end, right?
Yes, but I think there are some situations where, that TransCanada provide expertise in guiding what situations may be appropriate for their property.
I want to ask you about one other element of your commentary on the soil segregations issue. You commented that when wet conditions or compaction conditions exist, the topsoil, after it's been replaced, should also be ripped. You used the word ripped.
Yes.
Now, in this part of the country, ripping typically talks about using a tooth on a decompaction device that's 20 or 30 inches in length. You wouldn't suggest that a deep ripper be used on the topsoil because of the intermixing that goes with that, right?
In my experience, there are implements available that do not mix the topsoil. It's more of a pear plow shape that fractures the soil and then kind of it lifts it.
What you're looking for that topsoil lens, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
1 inch, 3 inches, 6 inches, 12 inches, to be decompacted.
Yes.
And, for example, using a traditional farm disc, pulled by a traditional farm tractor, in many instances will provide that, right?
In certain cases, yes. In the construction reclamation mitigation plan, Keystone stated its intent to use ripping implements, up to the depth of 18 inches, which I believe is appropriate for pipeline construction.
All right. So insofar as the topsoil goes, though, if any decompaction activities are taking place, your advice to TransCanada would be to avoid soil mixing and to use the conventional implements that are available to the farming community to decompact that topsoil, right?
In most situations, yes.
Thank you. In your commentary, there also is an issue about rock removal. At first, you suggested that all rock be removed to some depth, and then later you suggested to the extent practical the top 12 inches of topsoil rock be removed. TransCanada's policy is to return the topsoil conditions to those of the immediately adjacent soil. You find that acceptable also, do you not?
Yes.
And finally, lastly, you made the observation that all drain tile repairs that are undertaken should be done by qualified drain tile repair person. By qualified, you mean experienced.
I think the definition is similar. I revised the statement to be more consistent with that and the FERC's upland erosion revegetation maintenance plan.
Because there may be parts of the country where there are union drain tile persons, but in this part of the country there aren't.
That may be the case. I do not know.
All right. Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Dakota Rural Action.
Just have a few questions, Mr. Hargrove. Thank you. You say in your testimony that you reviewed the revised application, the CMRP, and other documents filed under the document, as well as Keystone's responses to data requests from the PUC staff, and that you also reviewed comments submitted by the PUC, by the public, and or interveners. And I particularly have questions about what comments were received in the CRMP by interveners.
I do not believe there were any.
Were there any comments from the public on the CRMP?
None that I'm aware of.
Is the CRMP also subject to review under the federal EIS process, NEPA process?
I am not certain, but I would speculate that it is.
Did you review any of the comments concerning by the public, provided by the public at the public hearings on soil and soil erosion problems or soil compaction and mitigation reclamation plan?
I don't recall any specific comments, but I did review the scoping summary document prepared by the Department of State.
Okay. But not the transcripts from the hearings held by the PUC on this pipeline?
No, I did not.
Did staff convey any of the comments provided by the public to you on soil problems and concerns with construction mitigation?
We have had some discussions, yes.
What were those discussions?
Some discussions regarding soil decompaction and then crop monitoring.
Were they related to any particular lands or any particular landowners?
No, they were not.
Have you reviewed any of TransCanada's actual construction process and their existing in the Keystone 1 or Keystone East pipeline in terms of how they're actually implementing the construction plan, reclamation mitigation plan?
I'm not familiar with how construction is currently going on that project.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Commissioners, questions of Mr. Hargrove?
I have just one for you here. I got to get to it. There it is. You say environmental inspectors in your direct testimony, page 3. Could you give me a little more insight as to an environmental inspector, or what their certifications would be, what their qualifications would be?
Sure. Keystone commits to the use of environmental inspectors during construction. In my experience, these are full-time, dedicated inspectors to support the contractor, you know, implement conditions of permits, and then also basically ensure compliance with permits and other agreements that TransCanada has made. There is no, you know, specific qualifications, but in my experience, most of them have a lot of experience with environmental regulations and implementation of best management practices and pipeline construction techniques.
Okay. Would they be employed by the commission normally, or would they be employed by TransCanada?
They would be employed by TransCanada.
Okay. Would they report to the commission, no?
No, they would not.
They would not. So this inspector that you're speaking about is a TransCanada employee who is on that side of the fence,
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And you said that you basically agree with Mr. Arndt's testimony, or you do agree with everything in Mr. Arndt's testimony?
Yes.
Okay. And do you see any problems with the clay and the other erosion factors that we've covered so extensively?
I really can't comment on specific soils issues.
Okay.
I do not have the background. But as far as erosion concerns, you know, I believe that the plan provided by TransCanada, you know, in addition to some of my recommendations, I believe is, you know, in close adherence to industry standards.
Okay.
and are likely to be effective.
Okay. And then I just have one more clarifying question. In your supplemental, you have the construction mitigation reclamation plan review, and you added some of that stuff, you said?
Yes, I revised some statements within the plan based upon rebuttal testimony from Steve Hicks.
Okay. And the best way for me to see what was there and what was not is a stare and compare. Or is everything in here your words, or is part of it your words and part of it their words?
All the changes are in my words.
In yours, okay. So in your supplemental, this is all your recommendations?
Yes, it is.
Okay. That's what I need to know. Thank you.
Mr. Hargrove, I did note those changes that you'd made to your supplemental testimony. I tried to compare it with what the Hicks rebuttal with what you had added. What I didn't see if there were substantial areas of disagreement still remaining. Are there?
I do not believe so.
Okay. And then at the very beginning, someone asked you, I think Ms. Semler asked you if what the applicant has laid out is consistent with industry best practices with regard to construction mitigation and reclamation. And you said, you hesitated a bit, and then you said, in general, yes. And the hesitancy, you know, raised a question in my mind, as well as the answer, in general, yes. So I'll ask it a little different way. Are there things the applicant has proposed that are not consistent with industry best practices, and if so, what?
Well, when I conducted the review, it's against a document prepared by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and appropriate to the entire country. What I did in my review is, you know, I tried to clue in, you know, to topics that I thought were important in South Dakota and the landscape that would be affected by the pipeline project. So that's why I say that they're in general, they're in compliance with industry standards.
So was anything that the applicant has proposed inconsistent with industry standards?
Just those that I identified in that review document.
Okay. And so maybe inconsistent isn't the right word. I mean, substandard. I mean, was anything below which the industry generally feels comfortable?
There were some things in the original document that I thought were below the industry standards, and I identified those in my review. In some situations, TransCanada provided rebuttal, and I, you know, tried to address those where I thought was appropriate. But in other cases, TransCanada seems fine with my changes.
Great, thanks.
Commissioner Hansen, do you have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Hargrove, I really appreciate your recommendations and the information that you provided to us. One of your recommendations is that the PUC require Keystone to utilize floating sediment curtains. I'm familiar with other methods of mitigation for sedimentation, but not with those type of curtains. Could you explain how those function? It seems fairly obvious just from the name itself, floating. They float, but I don't know just how they work.
Yes, I mean, it's basically a curtain with floats on top, which can be installed in areas of open water to prevent migration of turbid water or heavier sediments outside of the construction right of way. I identified it as a recommendation because in Keystone's application, they identified several small reservoir or stock ponds, which may be crossed by the project. In that case, I think that a measure like that would be appropriate to limit impacts to the construction right of way.
Do you know what type of materials they use to construct those?
They're usually made out of kind of a geotextile or plastic fabric.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Other commissioner questions or advisor? Mr. Rizlov.
I just had one. It occurred to me that there may be people along the route that may desire a different method of, I'll call it harrowing along the strip or, you know, loosening the soil than what the company would recommend. Would it be your recommendation that if a farmer, rancher, whatever, wants a different method utilized, that they should be able to do it?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any last commissioner questions? Ms. Sandler.
I don't have any clarification.
Any applicant follow on to the commissioner questions?
Two questions. You've worked as an environmental inspector on a crude oil pipeline project, have you not?
Yes, mostly in terms of pipeline right-of-way restoration. I have managed environmental inspectors on large-scale projects, and I've also served as a compliance monitor on projects as well.
Typically, the environmental inspector, while employed by the owner, in this case TransCanada, is really the owner's eyes and ears that assure that the contractor complies with the environmental provisions of the construction contract and of the permit, right?
Yes.
So you're the insulation between the contractor and you're the person who's keeping an eye on the contractor to make sure they do what they're obligated to do on behalf of the owner.
That is correct.
Second question, the floating sediment curtains, to be clear, you recommended use of floating sediment curtains in those situations where the water depth is greater than bale height, right?
Bale height or silt fence height, yes.
Yes, bale height or silt fence height. And finally, just one other point. The FERC plan and procedures that are used for construction mitigation and reclamation plan review, the FERC procedures are routinely modified by the applicant, are they not? And then ultimately approved by the FERC?
Yes, that is possible. On natural gas pipeline projects, it is common for an applicant such as TransCanada to request variances to certain provisions within the plan. These variances are considered on a more of a site-by-site basis or can be project-specific as well.
And typically that's to take a nationalized plan and reduce it to a localized plan, is it not?
That is correct, and that was the focus of some of my revisions to my original plan, was to make it flexible in certain instances where I thought that would be appropriate.
In fact, in your exchange with TransCanada through the DRs and so forth, you've resulted in a more localized plan, have you not?
That is correct.
Thank you very much. No further questions.
Mr. Blackburn,
follow-up? No further questions.
Any last staff follow-up?
No.
Okay, thank you. I think, Mr. Hargrove, you may step down.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'd call Mr. William Walsh to the stand, please.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Mr. Walsh, please introduce yourself to the commission.
Good afternoon. My name is William Walsh. I'm employed with EN Engineering as a senior project manager in the Metallurgy Group. My business address is 7135 Janes Avenue, Woodridge, Illinois, 60517. My educational background, I have a BS in engineering mechanics and an MS in metallurgical engineering, both from the University of Illinois, and I have a PhD in theoretical and applied mechanics from Northwestern University. My work experience, I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Illinois. I'm currently a senior project manager at EN Engineering. My work responsibilities include steel mill and pipe mill audits, development of welding procedures for pipeline construction projects, conduction of failure analyses, and performance of fitness for service analyses for pipeline components. I've also worked as a metallurgist for Natural Gas Pipeline Company of America with similar responsibilities. In addition to my pipeline experience, I've also had research experience in pipeline issues of stress corrosion cracking and residual strength of corroded pipelines at Battelle Columbus Division as a research scientist. In addition, I've worked in the manufacturing field as a project engineer for Snap-on Tools and Rexam Beverage Can. Rexam Beverage Can.
Mr. Walsh, can I ask you to pull that mic real close because you're really quiet.
Sorry about that.
Did you write and submit pre-filed testimony for this matter?
Yes, I did.
Did you write and submit some supplemental testimony for
this
matter?
Yes, I did.
And do you see those in front of you as S7 and S8?
Yes, I do.
And if I asked you those questions today, would you answer them all the same?
Yes, I would.
What area of the application did you review?
I reviewed the application for compliance to Federal Code Part 195, particularly the reporting and documentation applications, also the design, construction, and the operation and maintenance portions of that code.
And from your testimony, it appears that extensive quantity of documents must be provided to PHMSA as part of its safety compliance. Is that an accurate depiction?
Yes. The reporting requirements are operation and maintenance plans, which also includes the emergency response procedures, integrity management plan, a damage prevention program, continuing public education program, and operator qualification program. Also, Part 194 requires an oil spill response plan, which does require PHMSA approval, as well as an anti-drug plan and an alcohol misuse plan.
And you did just touch on it, but I'll just ask again. One of those plans must be approved by PHMSA, and if you could explain that approval.
The oil spill response plan needs approval by PHMSA.
Aside from that example of where approval is required, generally, could you describe to us PHMSA's role regarding all of those working plans of the applicant?
Yes. The agency responsible for the oversight of pipeline safety is the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, commonly referred to as PHMSA. PHMSA's role in pipeline projects such as this is largely one of an auditor. They review the documents and the plans that I mentioned earlier for compliance during the construction and operations phase of the program. So they're looking for compliance with the programs that were provided by the applicant, and also for compliance with the federal codes.
There's a big difference then between what the PUC is doing this week and what PHMSA's role will be throughout the life and beyond of this pipeline. Is that accurate?
Yes, the Public Utilities Commission hearing is the opportunity for the applicant to provide evidence that the facility will not harm the environment or the citizens of the state to the commission, whereas PHMSA's role is largely one of auditing of compliance to the plans that I mentioned.
And the same audits that you've mentioned and compliance checks do occur after the useful life or abandonment, which sounds as if it's very unlikely. So if you could comment to the likelihood first of abandonment and then the continuing audits and compliance checks that will occur.
Well, the likelihood of abandoning a facility of this size, I would feel is small, just based on historical data of abandonment. There has been some talk about the abandonment phase, so I think it would be worthwhile to read from the code just what is required for abandonment of pipeline. This is from CFR 195, and this is for the this is in the operation and maintenance plan that the applicant must come up with. Part of that plan has to deal with the abandonment of pipeline facilities. So the code reads, abandonment of pipeline facilities, including safe disconnection from an operating pipeline system, purging of combustibles, and sealing abandoned facilities left in place to minimize safety and environmental hazards. For each abandoned offshore pipeline facility or each abandoned onshore pipeline facility that crosses over, under, or through commercially navigable waterways, the last operator of that facility must file a report upon abandonment of that facility in accordance with 195.59, which is an earlier section of the code. So it basically says that the responsibilities are to purge the pipeline of combustibles so there will not be a danger fire or explosion, getting the substance below the lower the LEL. So the and the reporting responsibilities are come into play in the areas of navigable waterways only.
And I won't get into a lot of detail regarding the special permit. We've heard a lot about it already. Just want to confirm that depth of cover is an element and will be enforced by PHMSA.
Yes, the special permit requires a 48-inch depth of cover, which was explained earlier.
You also studied the planned placement of valves along this pipeline. Give just a brief explanation, if you could, as to why it's so important to properly plan for the placement of those valves.
The placement of valves is largely a function of protection of the environmental concerns. It takes into account the unusually sensitive areas, the HCAs, the high consequence areas, in order if there was a release of a release of product. So the in the state of South Dakota for this project, there's 16 mainline valves in place, and I've reviewed the spacing of those with regard to elevation, the relationship to water bodies, and the USAs and HCAs, and I found the spacing to be adequate, in my opinion.
Do you have any other recommendations based on your evaluation of the application?
No, I don't have any other recommendations at this time.
No further questions.
Applicant, is that Mr. Taylor?
It is Mr. Smith. Dr. Walsh, I'm William Taylor and represent TransCanada. I'd like to talk to you for a moment about PHMSA and draw an analogy. PHMSA is like the IRS, isn't it? It sets the rules, it expects the taxpayer to comply with the rules, and then it audits to be sure that the taxpayer has complied with the rules. Substitute pipeline owner for taxpayer, and you have the same system.
That appears to be an apt analogy.
So while PHMSA does not come out and do an inspection every day, it may come out and do an inspection for compliance on a periodic basis to make sure that your operations are complying with the many standards and rules that PHMSA has set, right?
That's correct.
And in this case, this pipeline, like the Keystone 1 pipeline, has a whole set of conditions, special conditions attached to its operational, attached to its operations because of the special permit, right?
Correct.
And PHMSA also audits for compliance with those conditions.
Yes, that's correct.
And the same is true with abandonment. Now, in the abandonment world, when, if, and should that ever happen, abandonment is really not the right word. It's demobilization or taking it out of service is really the correct word, isn't it? Decommissioning, I think, is the word you use.
The code calls it abandonment, abandoning pipeline facilities, so...
The pipeline company doesn't just get to walk away, though.
Some of that is dependent on the easement agreements, I believe.
But the pipeline company has to purge the line. Yes?
Yes.
And it has to ensure the continued mechanical integrity of the line for a period of time, does it not?
Yes.
And it has to maintain, for example, the corrosion protection devices for a period of time.
For abandonment, that's not called for.
CP is not, continued CP is not called for?
If it's inactivating the line where it's for future use or sale perhaps, then it would be certainly good practice to maintain the corrosion protection on the line.
In any event, if whatever the regulations are that govern operations or that govern abandonment, in addition to auditing for compliance, PHMSA also has the legal authority to enforce compliance, does it not?
Yes, it does.
And it has an enforcement arm.
Yes.
Thank you. That's all the questions.
Mr. Blackburn.
Let's get back to my other set of notes here. Excuse me, just bear with me a second.
Yeah, take your time.
In your testimony, you note, just trying to get back to the exact language that I'm looking for here. You state, in general, plans and DUP programs are not, quote-unquote, approved, the quotations are your quotations, by PHMSA. Rather, PHMSA inspection process reviews the documents for adequacy during compliance audits. Why do you put that in quotations, that word approved in quotations?
Because the one filing that does require approval is the oil response plan in part 194.
Yeah, but you say that in general plans and programs are not approved. So you're talking about the ones other than that particular one that is approved.
Correct.
And why do you use the term approved but put quotations around it? Why don't you just say it's not approved?
I could say not approved, and I think that would have the same effect.
And in the regulations, the term that is used for the process that PHMSA goes through is that they conduct, for example, with the Integrity Management Plan, they conduct an audit of that plan before the pipeline is put into operations.
That's correct.
They use the term audit of the plan.
I'd have to look up the what the language is in the code. There are other witnesses that are taking care of the integrity management portion of the code.
Well, I just looked through 195, and it only uses the word audit in two places, and that's related to operations taken by the operator, not by PHMSA. So it doesn't appear that the regulation actually uses the term audit for any of the actions it takes in implementing its regulations. So are you sure that that audit isn't a word that you're using, but not that the regulations use?
I'm using the word audit because that's largely the function of what PHMSA does.
And I appreciate your correction that the word abandonment is in fact the term that's used in the regulation to describe these facilities. But it's remarkable that you said that you don't think that this pipeline will ever be abandoned. So this pipeline will operate in perpetuity. Is that what you're saying?
I said it was unlikely.
I think it's a mischaracterization of the testimony. I think unlikely was the word used.
Well, in that case, it's unlikely to be abandoned in perpetuity?
it is unlikely to be abandoned.
Ever?
Certainly within the 50-year life cycle, that the 50-year design cycle that it's that was mentioned earlier.
So what you're saying is that after the 50-year design cycle, that the pipeline at some point would be abandoned because it would no longer be in use and be abandoned.
It's very difficult to say what the future of the pipeline will be. My opinion is that it is unlikely that it will be abandoned in the near future.
So pipelines have nearly an indefinite lifetime, is that, or in the near future, is that what you're saying? So you're qualifying your testimony now to say that it's unlikely to be abandoned in the near future.
Mr. Smith, I'd object to the form of the question. It's argumentative and assumes a plethora of facts that are far from in evidence. This is not a debate, it's a question and answer proceeding.
I don't know, Mr. Blackburn, is there a rephrasing or that you could do? I think I understood the question, actually, but maybe try it again, because I'm sure by now he's forgotten what it was anyway.
As I remember your testimony now, you said, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's the likelihood of abandoning a facility of this size is small. Is that correct?
I don't remember my exact words, but I believe that it is unlikely that it would be abandoned.
And what I'm trying to get at here is that you are not describing this, or you're discussing this without in the context of time, because abandonment doesn't happen instantly, nor does corrosion of pipelines, which is one of the factors that leads to pipeline. Well, let me rephrase the question. Do pipelines corrode over time?
There are corrosion avoidance measures that are put in place
That's not my question. Do pipelines corrode over time?
Everything corrodes over time.
Thank you. Given that everything corrodes over time, isn't it true that at some point in this pipeline, the steel in the ground, that pipeline will start to corrode and gradually weaken to the point where it's no longer serviceable? At some point in time in the future.
I can't say that for sure.
And you've testified that you are an expert in metallurgy and corrosion. Isn't that correct?
I have a degree in metallurgical engineering.
And you're not, and you don't have no opinion about whether this pipeline would corrode over time.
Well, the time frame is important also. I did say that it would corrode over time. So at some point it would corrode, yes.
Also, you cited CFR 195.59, but you didn't cite 195, you also didn't say that part of the element of 195.59 is that the pipeline, the report must include, if they do a report, compliance with other laws, applicable laws, as part of the abandonment process. Isn't that correct? I mean, doesn't the code require require compliance with other laws?
Reporting to the National Pipeline Mapping System, is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah, but in my testimony, I was reading the .195.402, which referred to .195.59.
You also mentioned that when counsel for applicant questioned you about whether the federal government had control over abandonment,
that other kinds of requirements might exist other than federal requirements, legal requirements for abandonment, such as easements.
Correct. The agreement for the easement would come into place after the abandonment, if there was such an agreement that referred to the abandonment of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. And once a pipeline is purged, sealed, and disconnected from other pipelines, which is what the totality of federal requirements are for abandonment, are there any other federal requirements other than those requirements?
Those are the only requirements that I am aware of.
Are there any requirements that the pipeline operator, once those things are accomplished, any federal requirements that the pipeline operator maintain that pipeline once those three things are done?
Not to my knowledge.
Are you aware of any laws in the United States that require a pipeline operator to remove abandoned facilities?
No, I'm not.
Have you worked on any professional experience in a pipeline abandonment proceedings or disputes or litigation?
No, I have not.
Have you done any surveys or reviews of pipeline abandonment in the United States?
No, I have not.
Also, the Council for TransCanada described the IRS code as being somewhat similar to the PHMSA process in the sense that the IRS sets up standards and then does audits to ensure compliance of those standards. And you agreed that that was an apt, appropriate analogy, and said that that whereas what this and what and they also described this commission as being concerned about safety and doing a permit that would review the safety of the pipeline and consider those issues, and that PHMSA would just simply conduct an audit of applicants' compliance with PHMSA regulations. Isn't it true, though, that PHMSA regulations, the entire point of PHMSA regulations is to ensure public safety?
PHMSA is responsible for the pipeline safety, yes.
So in that sense, therefore, PHMSA's compliance with PHMSA requirements is intended to promote public safety, and in fact, PHMSA has more authority than this commission does to control safety require safety and safety regulations related to pipelines.
That's my understanding of this commission's charge.
And is it your understanding that PHMSA is charged too?
Yes.
Have you ever drafted an emergency response plan or been involved in the drafting of an emergency response plan?
No, I have not.
Have you ever worked for PHMSA and reviewed emergency response plans?
Be employed by PHMSA?
Yes.
No, I have not.
Have you ever been involved in any way with the development of an emergency response plan?
No, I haven't.
So your opinion about how PHMSA operates and approves emergency response plan is based on. Could you describe what knowledge that's based on?
I'm going to object that this witness isn't on the stand to analyze the emergency response plan, nor PHMSA's process regarding the emergency response plan. Testimony was offered simply to state that it must be approved by PHMSA, period.
But the witness is testifying is in part testifying that the applicant is complying with federal law, and I want to know what the basis for the witness's experience and knowledge is to ensure that, in fact, the applicant is complying with federal law.
Federal law requires filing, period. PHMSA does the rest. I believe this commission's opinion does it is irrelevant.
That is Ms. Semler's opinion about how the process works at PHMSA, and I wanted to see whether this witness could actually describe how that process works, because that's an opinion not grounded in, for example, the testimony of TransCanada's witness Hayes yesterday.
My objection stands. It's outside the scope of this witness's testimony, and it's irrelevant to this process.
I guess the only testimony I recall him having about the emergency response plan is just that it he calls it the oil. What was the words you used were not that. They were
oil spill response plan
requires approval. I'm just going from recollection. Is there anything else that he testified to regarding that?
He described the process that they sent. They sent the plan. They had a meeting with PHMSA. PHMSA sent them a letter. PHMSA required a number of changes in the plan. TransCanada changed the plan. So actually, there was quite an engaged process between PHMSA and TransCanada during that effort. And here, just to read the witness's own testimony, said it describes the process. The oil spill response plan is submitted in duplicate to PHMSA. The Office of Pipeline Safety of PHMSA will approve the plan if it meets all requirements of Part 194. If PHMSA determines that the plan does not meet...
I think we're testifying here now.
So. I'm not testifying. I'm reading the app. I'm reading the witnesses.
I'm not getting any of this on the record.
I will reread the witness's own testimony.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where we stop. I will...
Correct. Where I stopped is here, just to read the witness's own testimony. It describes the process of oil spill response plan, submit a duplicate, and then...
And I can read the witness's testimony is, quote, the oil spill response plan is submitted in duplicate to PHMSA. The Office of Pipeline Safety of PHMSA will approve the plan if it meets all requirements of Part 194. If PHMSA determines that the plan does not meet all the requirements, they will notify the operator of apparent deficiencies and provide opportunity for the operator to respond. The witnesses testified on the process at PHMSA. I am not testifying myself. I'm just describing it. What I'm doing is establishing the witnesses' knowledge and experience in working with PHMSA to know whether that's truly what happens at PHMSA.
And I would argue that's a function of the code. That's what the code requires, period.
Well, I'm going to overrule the objection and allow the commission or the question to be answered to the best you can, you know.
The testimony was based on discussion with PHMSA of what the procedure is.
Thank you.
Commissioner, questions?
At some point, and I'm paraphrasing here, Mr. Walsh, my apologies, you had mentioned that the location of the valves was due primarily to environmental safety. I mean, wouldn't the totality of the location of the valves be dependent on environmental safety? I mean, I understand that there's vehicular access and electric reliability, but all of those things really flow into environmental safety. Is that right?
Right. That's correct. The other aspects that you did mention were included in a data request that the applicant had responded to one of my questions.
But ultimately, those are all related in a rather direct way toward environmental safety. You know, you want to have vehicular access so that you can ensure if something else doesn't work, you can get there quickly to minimize environmental impact. Is there anything outside of, I mean, is there anything I'm missing? Would anything other than environmental safety be considered?
No, that's primarily the goal of valve placement.
And then we've had some discussion about time as a factor for corrosion. How would you compare the effect of time on corrosion as opposed to, I mean, how does it compare to integrity management? I mean, is time a bigger component of corrosion, or is integrity management practices more important to the rate of corrosion?
Are we discussing after abandonment or?
In an operational pipeline.
In an operational pipeline, there are procedures in place and corrosion protection activities that are run by pipeline company, cathodic protection, coating of the pipeline, to minimize corrosion. So the intent is to not have the pipeline corrode at all while it's in service because of these measures.
And I don't want to talk about forever because I think that is a tough concept, at least for me to grasp. So let's focus. For instance, the applicant indicates that in 29 years of utilizing cathodic protection and FBE coating, that they have not had any failures on those pipelines. I believe that was the testimony. And that to the extent that those sections of pipeline have been excavated, that there has been no evidence of corrosion. Do you think that that's a reasonable expectation for this commission to have, that would be the experience, not just over 29 years, but say over 50 years, or something along that terms of time frame?
To have absolutely no corrosion?
To have no evidence of corrosion.
I would think that would probably be unlikely. There are other activities such as inline inspection where you're looking for the corrosion and you're actively trying to find it and mitigate it.
So I'm going to pause for just a minute because I think it was in Ms. Cathari's testimony. And if you'll give me just a few seconds, I want to ask you about that. Ms. Cathari's testimony, she says, there have been no leaks on this type of pipe, she's talking about FBE coated pipe, installed by TransCanada with the FBE coating and cathodic protection system during that time. When TransCanada has excavated pipe to validate FBE coating performance, there has been no evidence of external corrosion. So do you find that hard to believe?
If it has been properly maintained and the coating is intact the cathodic protection is in place, you would expect it not to corrode.
So then help me understand how we get to, you wouldn't be surprised that this would be the experience over 29 years, but when we get out to 50, you would be surprised not to have any evidence of corrosion. Am I missing an important component here? Or?
If all of the corrosion, the cathodic protection systems are in place and activated, it should be the same 29 or 50. If the corrosion protection systems are turned off in an abandonment case, then the pipe would start to corrode if there was access to the pipe through the coating, through damage or some other.
Okay, thank you.
Means.
I have nothing further, Mr. Smith. Thanks.
Other commissioner questions?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. You have, and I may be piggybacking a little bit on Commissioner Johnson's questions. You had set forth in your testimony on Exhibit A and in other areas, you gave the five areas that where you think that should determine where locations of valves are. And I'm going to try to ask a question that deals with the Exhibit B, which is a confidential exhibit. However, I'm hoping that neither my question nor your answer will involve anything confidential. And so I'd like you to pause after I ask the question and make sure that I have not trespassed in that area. And the attorney for the, let's think of Ms. Semler as being an attorney for the citizens. She is a staff member of the PUC, however, and it will give her an opportunity to intercept anything that I may trespass on. First of all, do you know that in Exhibit B, you talk about the location where the potential for the highest or for the greatest contamination that could take place as a result of a pipe failure, if I'm phrasing that properly. It reminds me of putting it in perspective, the analysis that is done on an annual basis in the larger cities as to which intersection is the worst intersection. And we always keep in mind not to get too excited about it because there will always be the worst intersection, regardless of once we bring down some of the challenges there, we now have another worst intersection. So keeping that in mind, I don't mean to try to do away with the worst-case scenario in every instance, because once we do away with that, we're going to be in the next challenge. However, I am concerned from the standpoint of whether or not this has a remotely controlled valve, and this is in a remote area, certainly. So are you aware of whether this has a remotely controlled valve? And it appears that you can answer that question.
I don't recall if it does or not. When I was looking at the analysis, I knew, but I can't go by memory on this.
So I'm going to assume that you don't know. If you don't know that, you certainly don't know the distance to an electrical power supply.
That's correct. I didn't know that. The distance.
Okay. Would someone be able to get that to us, please?
Yes.
And Attorney Brett Kennedy is saying yes. Thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolbeck, did you have a question?
Yes. You spoke in your, this isn't in your direct testimony per se, but you've had your responsibilities in your past positions are materials for pipes and components and stuff like that. Would you say that the pipe that the applicant is using is of the highest quality or of the most up-to-date in technology?
Based on the requirements for the 80% 80% special permit, they are required to use API 5L PSL2, which has high fracture resistance properties compared to PSL1, which is all that is required in the case of where there would not be that. Where they would not need the permit. So, yes.
Okay. I think I have the decommissioning thing straight in my mind. In your opinion, a company can continue to do the corrosion protection, or they may choose not to. Was that your testimony?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. And if they choose to, it would probably be because they want to keep the pipe in a saleable state, maybe.
I believe so.
Or convert it to ethanol pipeline or whatever it may come about. Do you know of any problems in the United States right now with decommissioning of pipelines?
No, I don't.
Okay. You had ever had any experience with?
No. I'm specifically referring to what the code requires.
Okay. You're basically telling me that the code says they have to decommission. Okay.
Correct.
You're not necessarily elaborating your testimony on digging into the FEMA regulations.
Correct.
Okay. Perfect. I think I had one more. I think that's it for now. Thank you.
Additional commissioner questions? Commissioner Johnson, do you have another question? Hearing none. Wait a minute. Commissioner Colbeck. Okay.
Sorry. Just so I have your testimony correct, when you say that a pipeline may never cease to be in use, or the pipeline may never corrode and go out of use, is that your testimony? Could you refresh me?
If it's protected with the corrosion protection measures, right? If those are turned off, you could expect the pipeline to start corroding.
To start corroding? Okay. Or stop corroding.
Start, yeah.
Okay. And referring to Commissioner Johnson's questions a little bit, were you trying to say that a pipeline, thinking of a pipeline in an entirety, you could replace parts if they did corrode so that a pipeline in the entirety may never go out of commission? Was that the point you were trying to make? Or were you trying to say that a specific chunk will never corrode?
Your first statement was correct.
Okay.
If pipelines do, if they do corrode, they can be replaced or repaired. I don't know if that's.
I think I said Mr. Johnson. I think I meant Mr. Blackburn.
So, okay.
But to think of it as corrosion, I guess, and you said that no, it could go on indefinitely. I was taking that as a pipeline in an entirety. You could replace sections along the way. You may get corrosion along the way, but the pipeline, per se, may never stop being used for one reason or another.
That's correct.
Okay, so I think I understood what you were saying. All right, thank you.
Any follow-up? Any other commissioner questions? Commissioner Hansen?
I shouldn't, but I shall. do you have any familiarity at all with in situ form?
No, I do not.
Do you have any familiarity at all with the lining of pipe, the process of lining pipe, the interior of pipe?
Internal coating of pipe? Just that it is done and often and sometimes required for different applications.
Do you know if it is, it can be accomplished in pipe the size of what TransCanada is laying here?
Yes, it can, but the internal coating for pipe is typically to increase the flowability and not corrosion aspects.
Certainly. I don't want to testify, so I won't say anything further. Thank you.
Commissioners, are you done? Staff?
I have just two clarification questions. One, corrosion control takes up an entire body of code. Is that accurate? It's very specific and in-depth.
Are you referring to Part 195 code?
Correct.
Yes.
And I think there was an attempt maybe earlier to portray that there's some joint pipeline safety responsibilities in this aspect of pipelines between PHMSA and the PUC. And as a non-lawyer, it's impossible for you to draw legal conclusions regarding any joint responsibility, or you've not cited any case law that would indicate there's preemption issues. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Nothing further.
Okay, follow-up applicant to commissioner questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. You know, Dr. Walsh, something that nobody talks about is that an owner who invests, say, $10 billion in the construction of a pipeline that runs from Canada through the United States, it's also reasonable to expect that the owner will protect its property, isn't it?
I would think that would be reasonable.
In fact, many of the corrosion protections that are installed on this pipeline and operated by the owner are designed to do just exactly what we've talked about, and that is to control corrosion indefinitely, isn't it?
The if that's the intent of the applicant, then it is. But the I'm just saying that the corrosion measures are effective for stopping corrosion.
Yes. And the science of corrosion control has made great strides and advancements in the last decade or so, has it not?
Yes, it has.
And this pipeline, from the best you can tell, has all of those advanced corrosion protections, does it not?
There is a... another witness who will be examining the corrosion aspects of the code.
Mr. Schramm.
Mr. Schramm, yes.
When we discuss compliance auditing by PHMSA, unlike the IRS, compliance auditing by PHMSA is something that is ongoing and frequent, is it not? For example, during the course of construction, you would expect that there will be PHMSA auditors or inspectors who show up to audit compliance with the requirements.
That's correct.
In fact, frequently show up to check the status of construction.
I wouldn't. The frequency varies from project to project.
It's a question I shouldn't ask, but I, like Mayor Hansen, I can't resist asking. You're aware of the fact that there are 60-year-old pipelines operating in South Dakota right now?
I'm aware that there's 60-year-old pipelines operating. I don't know if they're in South Dakota or not.
Mayor Hansen and I know of one that... that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Mr. Blackburn, do you have any follow-up to the commissioner questions?
Yes, I think one question, or a number of questions here that will help to clarify this. You've described the design life of this pipeline. The state and TransCanada has stated that there is a design life for this pipeline. Is that correct?
I recall, I don't know who said it, but somebody did mention a design life within these hearings.
Do pipelines typically...
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Blackburn. If we could speak a little more clearly into the microphone, Mr. Walsh, sorry. I think that will help folks on the Internet. Thanks.
I'm sorry. I said that was mentioned during these 2 days of hearings so far. I don't recall who had actually mentioned it, though.
Do pipelines typically have a design life?
Yeah, I believe they do. I mean, I've never been in on the portion of the design where I have to make a decision, but I do hear that. So,
do you know what the factors are that go into determining the design life of a pipeline?
I think we're outside the scope of this.
The commissioners were concerned about
the commissioners are concerned about how long this pipeline would last, and a number of the commissioners asked questions about that. I think that it's helpful, like with all machinery, you know, Commissioner Kobach asked about how long this pipeline could be maintained and what its life would be. Design life is essentially the term that's used to determine how long equipment like this will last. And so I think it's very much a response to the commissioner's questions.
Again, if you know, please, if you can.
Okay. I don't know.
Are you aware whether the pipe steel that's being used in this pipeline has internal coatings on it?
No, I'm not.
And you also described advanced corrosion protection. There was some discussion of advanced corrosion protection. As I understand it, it's the corrosion protections provided this pipeline are primarily cathodic protection and fusion bonded epoxy coating on the outside of the pipeline. Is to start with those two, is cathodic protection a new or advanced technology that's only come about in the last decade?
I'd like to defer that question to the witness who will be discussing the corrosion aspects of the line.
Mm-hmm. It's just that you had given an opinion about whether or not, you know, there have been new and advanced technologies included in this pipeline to prevent corrosion.
It's already been answered. I'd like to defer.
And so, since you gave an opinion on that, I wanted to find what the basis for that opinion was and what, in fact, new technologies were included in this pipe to prevent corrosion.
I'm going to overrule, but again, you know, you can answer within what you know.
The new technologies being FBE coatings, which have been very, very successful in mitigating corrosion.
And when were FBE coatings developed and used in steel preventing corrosion in steel?
I believe they've been in operation 25 or 30 years. But again, there are other witnesses who will be can be more accurate with that.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Staff, do you have any final rebuttal questions?
No.
Thank you. You may step down then, Mr. Walsh. Thank you very much. I know it's late in the day and you didn't have anything, did you, Bill?
No, I don't.
Okay. It gets tougher at this time of the day to hang in there. Thank you very much. Staff, did you want to try to work any additional witnesses? Well, maybe I should ask commissioners, since we're going to be going tonight, should we call it a day for now for the evidentiary portion of the hearing?
What's your staff's opinion?
Yeah, staff, do you have an opinion on that?
We have three witnesses that parties have stipulated to the fact can be available via phone, so we certainly could wait till tomorrow so we can handle those phone calls all in a chunk. It may be the best use of the commission's time.
Okay. I know earlier an attorney for the Attorney General's office we haven't had her make an appearance yet because her ground of people haven't been involved. Ms. Geed had mentioned to me that one of the DENR witnesses,
other arrangements.
Oh, he has?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that settled then? Do you want to right now, Roxanne, make your appearance and explain what your purpose in being here is? We can at least take care of that.
I will do that. Roxanne Geed, Assistant Attorney General. I'm appearing on behalf of a group of witnesses that have been subpoenaed by the PUC staff for the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Those witnesses are Derek Isles, Brian Walsh, and Kim McIntosh. And for the Division of History of the Department of Tourism, The witness is Paige Hoskinson Olson. They will be appearing. The only difficulty we had with arrangements was Mr. Isles, but he has agreed to stay overnight. So he will be here tomorrow, and so I think they'll all be here tomorrow to testify.
And maybe your role will be?
My role is limited solely to, I'm appearing solely on behalf of the witness. I will not be conducting direct examination like I did last time. I believe that your PUC attorney will be doing that. I am just here to assert any privileges or objections that may be personal to DENR, the Department of Tourism, as the proceedings go along.
Okay.
So hopefully I won't say a word.
Thank you. Then I think if we can't work anyone else in or it's not prudent to do so, we take advantage of the 1 hour and 7 minutes we have, and we can all try to get freshened up. We'll be in recess then until tomorrow morning at 8:30. Okay. Thank you, everyone. It's been a long day.
But maybe we'll reiterate for anybody listening that there will be a public input meeting tonight.
Right. At 6 o'clock in this room, we will be having an informal public input hearing at which any member of the public who's interested may appear and present their views to the commission. Thank you, everyone. We're in recess until 8:30.